something completely different. Okay, so I don't know. I don't know what all we're hoping to gain out of today's workshop, but so far it's been fun. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons why people have to turn to their computer. And I'm going to talk about one that's completely different, which is if you want to actually work with some data that's just, you're not going to be able to import it into your Blackboard. And I apologize, this talk is going to be very boring. All right, so the lessons I've learned about analyzing data, so this is really for someone, so people in the room who are experienced doing this, you can just look at your cell phone or whatever. If there are any students or people, postdocs, whatever, that maybe want to start doing something like this, these are just things that I've learned that I think having had this talk a little bit earlier in my career would have saved me some pain, so. Okay. So basically, like, I think, you know, it's just a sort of simple little things that I want to talk about that I go through anytime I want to try to start a project that's going to be a sort of long-term thing, analyzing a large data set. And I'll just sort of point out along the way a couple of little tools that I've used. Won't go into any detail, but maybe it'll spark some discussion or people can ask me follow-up questions later in case they're useful. So, okay. So the first thing, which I was reminded of quite recently, is to actually really make sure you know your data and make sure that you actually are able to sort of trust the data that's actually been handed off to you. So this is actually something that should be a very simple problem, but it's actually difficult. So obtaining an authoritative data set can be difficult because oftentimes what you'll be given is a data set that has flaws or some transfer of data will have resulted in the data being corrupted or something like that. And before you ever start down some project like this, make sure that you have a way of establishing some sort of authoritative connection with the person providing you data to make sure that what you've actually got makes sense. And there are tons of tools that can do this, but it really is critical. The other thing about data is people fix it all the time. So it turns out any time someone might make a data set, there's going to be a problem with it, and they're going to change it. And it's going to change at timescales depending on how reliable the source is, maybe once a week, maybe once a month, maybe never, but always check back and make sure that you've definitely integrated this into part of your analysis scheme. Okay, and the other thing is I would encourage people, and certainly something I've learned in lots of painful ways, is to make sure that you've actually, when creating data or reducing and processing data, be an authoritative data source for yourself and your colleagues. So some of the things Eric mentioned earlier about setting up version control repositories, SVN, Git, all of these things, actually pretty critical. So, I'm not making this up. So this is something that we learned quite recently. So I should say that what I do actually is I do gravitational wave analysis. And right now we're sort of embarking on preparing for the next generation of gravitational wave detectors. And so we're going through this large process, which I'll describe a little bit more at the end of the talk. And it turns out that there was a fairly significant bug in the data transfer system that was causing our data to actually be have blips where the data was being repeated. So like essentially data from the future was being repeated in small blips here. And this was of course causing enormous havoc, and it was all fixed by simply verifying the data was correct by doing simple things that are known algorithms like checksums and things like this on files. So this was a real thing. Okay, so now the other thing that is important to know is about the scale. And I think a lot of people are going to talk about scale issues today. And we've already heard a lot about scale in terms of numerical calculations. And you know, there are basically like a few things to consider when starting down this road that are basically the same as what you would have for any computational project. And the question is like, how long are you willing to wait for a given analysis to actually run on a computer? You sort of have timescales that are relevant, like cup of coffee timescales, lunchtime timescales, vacation timescales, and then things that, of course, are just impossible to compute, which we won't talk about. But odds are, like even for the simplest tasks, if you are sort of waiting for longer than a cup of coffee and you've not done parallelization, it's probably worth it. So it's probably worth investing the time to understand how to make your code run in parallel if possible if it takes longer than what it takes to go get a cup of coffee. So we'll talk a little bit about that. The other thing that's important is essentially data scale. This is true, of course, for people generating data as part of simulation sets. You all encounter this all the time. And most people have worked out ways of accessing and storing the data that work for them. But it's something to consider when starting down one of these projects as well, of course. Okay. So one of the things that's good usually about working with lots of big data sets like this, at least in my experience, most times parallelization is typically embarrassingly simple. So you don't actually have to do anything complicated like writing MPI code. You don't have to leverage things that have inter-process communication. You really just have to have something that you can run sort of multiple copies of. And typically all of the computers, even like our laptops and desktops, can provide a few cores of CPU power that can take things from, you know, lunch time scales to coffee time scales. And actually at this point, you don't even necessarily have to use full HPC facilities if you want something bigger. There are machines that themselves have 32 and 64 core machines, which again can turn things from long day time scales to very short time scales if you can leverage them. So don't be afraid to just seek out a resource like that. Here at PI, I don't know what our biggest machine is going to have. Eric, can you say? Yeah, what's the biggest single machine? 12, okay. Maybe we can...
That costs about, I think, $5,000. But that includes part of the storage and part of the networking infrastructure. So if you leave that out, it would probably be a third cheaper. But just a rough guess.
I was recently looking, so you can buy a 64-core machine for about $10,000. So it's getting simpler, right? Like, these things are simpler, and that's why I'm trying to point out today that you don't have to do crazy things to make your life a little bit simpler. The other thing is that, you know, also a lot, pretty much all the high-level languages right now support some sort of multi-threading or multi-processing or whatever. You don't have to, you know, write MPI code and all of this. It's often as simple as just, you know, importing a particular module in your favorite scripting language, and all of a sudden you can use all 12 cores or all 64 cores on your machine without much trouble. I would say that, you know, the big lesson I've learned is, you know, don't go after the more complicated parallelization until you've actually figured out all the simple ones first. But of course, when you have to, you will at some point maybe have to hit this road, and you can consider things like MPI, direct use of, you know, threading libraries, GPU acceleration, tempting. I think it's still a lot of work for what you get from it, but that's my own opinion. Okay, so the other thing that I say that's important for part of this is that, you know, it's the standard thing even when you have simulation data sets. They're going to be really large. You're not going to be able to just read them into memory. And it's going to be easier to learn about all of the tools that exist for file manipulation on disk and things rather than trying to, you know, write your own or come up with some creative way of doing it. If you're starting a project from scratch, you know, there are a couple of, I think, probably that are sort of the best open standard formats, depend on the type of data you have. If you have something that's really best described as large numerical arrays, HDF5, I think, is a no-brainer. It's supported in many languages. If your data is table-like in nature and has a lot of relational structure to it, astronomical data, things like this, I think it's really time to drop space to limited text files as a way of passing this stuff around and move to something that's, you know, been around since the 70s. Just bite the bullet and learn how to use a relational database. It'll make your life a lot easier. And it's there's actually some very simple file-based things in, that are available, like SQLite, which is essentially in every device you own. Like, it's controlling everything. All right. So, the software. Well, I think there are two places that I've gone wrong in the past, and I think this is very common for people to go wrong, and they're actually extremes. So you basically say, well, I don't need someone's software, or I don't need to learn a particular thing because I'm smart and I can do it myself. And you're right, you can. The only problem is that you would typically grossly underestimate how long it actually takes to do it. And so it's almost always better to invest the time and to work with someone or to work with a group of people who have solved at least part of the problem you're trying to solve and just sort of ride along with that. The other problem, actually, is sort of the opposite, which is that people latch on to something that does what they want, and they just stick with it without actually thinking about how it's going to go, you know, into the future as they're making more and more complicated calculations and more complicated analyses. Sort of the typical thing that I see, and that I've certainly done myself, is to choose some particular language which appears to make the problem simple for what I want to do, MATLAB, Mathematica, these sorts of things, and then to hit sort of problems whenever you want to maybe extend it to some HPC environment or whatever. There are lots of things you have to consider. You know, you have to consider licensing and all of these sorts of things. You know, what will your HPC provider give you? But, you know, there are lots of sort of open source alternatives to being able to do numerical calculations that, you know, you don't have to worry too much about. I use Python, Octave, GSL, FFTW for Fourier transforms. So I stopped using MATLAB a long time ago. But Octave is, the syntax is very similar. There are a couple of subtle differences. I think where Octave fails over MATLAB is in its plotting and GUI interface. The actual language itself and the libraries that it's using for numerical computation is very good. I know people who rely on it heavily. But if you're used to sort of the nice, friendly GUI environment of MATLAB, you won't get that from Octave. But you can try your MATLAB scripts right in Octave. And on usually about an hour's work, we'll get them working. So if you have a batch thing that runs in MATLAB, try it in Octave. Okay, so the other key thing that I've, you know, realized over the years is that it's really critical to be able to reproduce results. The problem often is that whenever you start down some project that you know is going to be a long haul, it grows organically. There's no way to avoid it. And so what you end up with is this thing that you don't really understand necessarily how things start and where exactly they end. At some point, you've managed to work through the whole thing. And if you've done that, then probably what you've done can be described by some sort of graph that, you know, where you have starting points and you understand dependencies and it results in a final answer. And I can't stress enough how important it is to start with that in mind from the beginning. It just makes things so much easier and lets you be able to reproduce your work early on and also let your colleagues do it as well. There are really simple things that exist out there to do this. You don't have to do anything complicated, and it's not a lot of work. I mean, the most simple sort of overlooked workflow manager out there is just make, the thing you type when you're compiling software. It can provide a way of resolving all the dependencies and giving you a start to finish for an entire workflow. It actually can do parallel calculations, and if you run make on a big machine and you have lots of little things that have to run, it'll just run the parallel parts of the graph in parallel. So it's kind of an amazing, simple thing that you can do. And of course, if you need something more complicated, one of the things that I hope to have working on the HPC system when it gets, you know, unheated, is to have the batch scheduling system that I like to use, which is called Condor. And Condor provides a slightly higher level interface to multiple machine resources by allowing you to execute like essentially a workflow. You know, something like this, where you can have something that has dependencies and things like this that all get sorted out. I was laughing at myself this morning as Eric said he wants to improve the interactive nature of HPC, and so this slide is all about how I think you should not do interactive things on HPC. No, I'm just kidding. I was just going to say that this is something also I think that, you know, I've done that it's been a problem in the past. Everything you type into a terminal is software, whether or not you want to believe it or not. So one of the things that, you know, has been useful for me is to just sort of actually start thinking from the mindset from the very beginning that everything I write will be a script that I can put into my workflow and that I can put under version control to avoid the typos that are inevitable when you're trying to do some sort of interactive analysis. Go ahead.
So, by saying that, it didn't mean that.
Yeah, I was, of course, giving you.
But when you write a script and debug it, you want to run it, and you want to have the script start running within
10
seconds, then you can start the script 10 times in a minute and flush out all the tests. But each time, that's the thing. But regarding scripts, you're right. It's just that while you're developing something, you want immediate access to the system. Because you run it only for 10 minutes, but it doesn't make sense to wait a day to run for 10 minutes.
No, and that's actually a good point. Excuse me. And I think this is something, like, I do hope that when the HPC is running here in Perimeter and we're actually all starting to use it, which will be kind of fun because, frankly, I have a feeling that by the end of the day, we'll realize we're all doing very different things and it'll be kind of fun to see how that interacts. I think the batch scheduling stuff, like, so I'm used to a very different batch scheduling environment that's actually designed to provide faster access to resources. So I think that the two things aren't mutually exclusive, so we can talk about that. Anyway, okay. So that's all. That was all the boring pedagogical stuff. I was hoping there'd be more students or something. All right, so now on to some shameless plugs for my own research. So I said all of these things, and I was actually not, wasn't clear that these are things I actually do, but they are things I actually do. So the tools that I've mentioned and the ideas are all here. So what I've been working on, well, for a long time, but specifically in the last year or so since I've been here, is preparing a real-time detection and localization strategy for gravitational wave events coming out of the Advanced Gravitational Wave Detector Network, which is going to be online around 2015. So our goal is to basically be able to, within sort of seconds of a merging neutron star or a black hole in the nearby universe, within seconds of the signal reaching Earth in gravitational waves, we want to be able to say, hey, look, we found it. We know we found it. And here's where it is roughly on the sky. So it's not surprising. Well, maybe it is surprising. Turns out this is a pretty big computational problem, actually. Maybe not as big as some of the ones that folks in the room work on. It takes around, right now, this analysis is occupying about 1,200 cores at the Caltech LIGO lab, sort of running nonstop as it's analyzing data. So it's a reasonable scale. And it actually involves parallelization at all sorts of scales. There's the non-embarrassingly simple parallelization required to actually analyze a given set of parameter space from multiple detectors. And it's actually extremely complicated, highly threaded, you know, nest of dependencies operating on a single machine. And it's using essentially all kinds of open source tools to accomplish it. It's really quite a grab bag, some of the ones I mentioned earlier. But in addition, there is an embarrassingly parallel aspect to it. And what we actually use for that is just is Condor as our batch manager. And it essentially has 150 independent 8-core machines that it manages and keeps the analysis going. Basically, the different machines cover, it's hard to see this plot, but this is a chert mass of the binary. So roughly like the characteristic mass of a given binary. And essentially, we divided that up into multiple jobs that run on different nodes. And Condor manages all of this, and it just sort of takes care of when things fail and keeps it all moving along. I should say our configurations are all done with Make. Nothing complicated. And the goal, I hope, is after all of this work in this enormous grab bag of things we've learned over the past few years, is we should be able to identify candidates within about 30 seconds and plan an immediate coordinated electromagnetic follow-up campaign. This is actually an event. It's not a real event. Right now, we're doing a simulated analysis. Basically, the LIGO collaboration is generating data which is believed to represent what the advanced LIGO data will look like. And things are running, so it's going well. I hope to use the HPC system here for test bedding some of these things. So. Anyway, that's all I've got. Questions?
Okay, can you go back?
Yeah.
What's the immediate, just the last slide.
Sorry.
What's an immediate coordinated electromagnetic follow-up campaign?
Yeah, so basically the idea is, we hope, so it happened actually in our last, so the last real science run for gravitational wave data, like gravitational wave data taking, was in between 2009 and 2010, and it was with the initial detectors that weren't super sensitive, but they were good. And what we did was we did this sort of thing where we looked for gravitational waves and provided pretty bad sky localization. And then we had essentially worked out agreements with various optical telescopes and radio telescopes and even gamma ray telescopes like SWIFT. And whenever we identified something, we would send them the sky position, and they would essentially point towards it to see if there was an electromagnetic counterpart to the potential gravitational wave signal. Now, we made no detections in S6, so but we did actually exercise this for a couple of mildly interesting events.
So there are such installations ready to react on that time scale?
So
you call them? And
yeah, it's still being worked out, but yeah, some sites are able to respond more quickly than others, and of course it will involve buy-in from these other experiments. But there's this, you know, basically the two communities are trying to merge, and I actually have hope that by the time Advanced LIGO is running, that there will actually be several people who are willing to basically do this as quickly as possible. And of course, in 2030, when I'm hopefully getting ready to retire or something, I imagine most of this stuff will be automatic and routine. This is all brand new, right? This is an entirely new field.
You want to retire at 50?
Really,
you haven't been paying attention to the news, huh?